Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to former Major League Baseball player Doug Glanville, now an analyst with ESPN, about his new book, The Game From Where I Stand. Stick around.
Hey, did you know that you can listen to the latest Mr. Media show right on your phone with the Stitcher app? Stitcher's smart radio for your smartphone. Mr. Media is on demand and on the go with Stitcher. Download Stitcher for your phone today. Get the free app at www.stitcher.com. That's STITCHER.com.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 600 archived celebrity interviews for your listening pleasure. The show is brought to you today by ThePartyAuthority.us. Planning a wedding, mitzvah, or corporate event? For any and all occasions, call The Party Authority nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJS. That's 1-800-342-5357. Where one call does it all. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of neighborhood dogs in the new media capital of the world and home of the second best team in baseball, St. Petersburg, Florida. Lots of former baseball players write books about their glory days as a player, and many of those books are as much about their off-field careers as what happened between the foul lines. Womanizing, incessant drinking, shooting steroids, pranks, grudges, that's Jim Boughton, Jose Canseco territory. If that's your idea of a baseball book, steer clear of Doug Glanville's story, The Game From Where I Stand. His tale is more personal, more heartfelt, and far more clear-eyed. But what would you expect from the first African-American Ivy Leaguer to make it to the majors, or one who wrote an online column for the New York Times after retiring from the game? Doug Glanville is a different cat. You know, scratch that. Cat doesn't seem the right reference. Let's call him a different gentleman. Now, I've got a lot of questions for this veteran of 15 seasons with the Chicago Cubs, Philadelphia Phillies, and Texas Rangers. But I'm going to start with this one. Why does singer John Oates, that's right, the second half of Hall & Oates, rate an entire paragraph in the acknowledgments of his book? Doug Glanville, welcome to Mr. Media.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you. Appreciate your time. And why does John Oates rate a paragraph in your acknowledgement?
Well, I'll tell you what. It's, you know, growing up when I was about 12 years old, I heard one of their songs, and Hall & Oates became my favorite band, and I stayed true over the last 25-plus years. And, you know, interesting enough, when my sixth-grade teacher was married to a guy named John Sticks, and John edited a magazine called Guitar Magazine for the practicing musician. And when I turned 13, I went back to my sixth grade teacher's dinner for a dinner, and basically the husband, John, signed a nice sort of autographed copy of one of his magazines saying, "Hey, if you ever make it to the major leagues, I will introduce you to your favorite band, Hall & Oates." And he lived up to that, and I did eventually give him the call when I was with the Philadelphia Phillies. And since that day, it was probably 1998 or so, I've been friends with John Oates in particular. So his music inspired me. I like his story of being an underdog and also just a good guy.
All right. I hate to admit it, but that's a good story. It's worth a paragraph in your book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. it covers the gamut. But, yeah, music was a big part of playing baseball. We actually did a lot with theme music coming out to home plate, and John was a big part of that.
Well, I was going to ask you, in this day and age, wouldn't it be more fashionable to give props to Lil Wayne or Jay-Z or even Snoop? But I guess you have your good reasons.
Yeah, well, I stayed true. You know, my favorite team stayed my favorite team since I was five. So, but nope, still John Oates, still Hall & Oates, and I'm glad they're still making music.
Do you always wish that it was Oates and Hall, though?
Yeah, you know, I always wonder about that. Back in the day, in the 70s, 80s, they John Oates probably sang just as much as Daryl Hall, and then they kind of realized once their big mega hit, Private Eyes, all that came on, Daryl Hall was sort of the more charismatic singer, and so Daryl Hall became the lead man. But John Oates contributes quite a bit.
Well, so I got to ask you this, your taste in music. I mean, how does an Ivy Leaguer fit in best with a bunch of guys in a locker room many of whom were lucky to graduate high school if they did, or even in some cases escape island poverty, let alone go to college. Is that ever a difficult fit?
Well, you know, what I found was the biggest challenge was really the minor leagues, actually, because there you're kind of far from the promised land of Major League Baseball. You're searching, you're all sort of adjusting to being amongst peers or competitors that now are at your level. It's not like you were the big fish in the little pond like you may have been in your high school days. So, you know, it became more challenging to find my spot in the minor leagues, but I believe that's true for all players. They all come from somewhere, and their unique path has to find its space within the game. Once I got to the major leagues, it became sort of a coin of uniqueness, and I think that's a little bit more celebrated at the major league level. You know, if you're productive, you could be as colorful as you want to be. And, I think what added color to my life was a sort of unique academic background. And in the end, the players, you know, respected a lot. They made me a union representative for the team. I was involved in a lot of things, and I think it worked out very well. But it was a tough beginning.
I know with I'm in St. Petersburg with the Tampa Bay Rays. They have a guy who's unfortunately injured at the moment who went to Columbia University. And
yes.
I cast for the life of me. Fernandez?
Perez, yes.
Perez, thank you.
Yes.
And, seemed like a great guy. And again, a big deal was made of the fact that this guy is so literate, so well-educated. And, you know, I think there were some issues with him fitting in a little bit because he's reading very different things than the rest of the guys were.
Well, yeah, and actually I came across Fernando. We both submitted to a journal called the Southern Review. It's a LSU journal that comes out, I think, quarterly, and they had a baseball issue. And, I mean, his writing is, you know, it's deep. I mean, he's done a lot of different things, and I believe he was the first Latino-American Ivy League graduate. So we have a similar walk in that sense. But, you know, I believe the game evolves and changes, and you know, it's always there's a perception that because you're sort of this academic guy that you're not tough or you're not committed because you could do other things or you have other interests. And, you know, challenges that sort of conventional wisdom of you're more committed when your back's against the wall and you have nothing else. And I think that type of approach ends up doing a disservice to sort of creating balance and diversity of experiences that I think certainly will help players set themselves up when their career is over, which usually is in your 30s. So, you know, to prepare for that life after the game, it's certainly better for the player to have other interests.
Doug, your dad, to whom you dedicate the book, he was a Harvard man. Was he comfortable with you? And I know he's since passed, but was he comfortable with you pursuing baseball as a career?
Well, you know, both my parents were academics, and my father was from Trinidad, and he sort of migrated over to the United States when he was 31 years old, already established as a teacher. So they both kind of were like, well, this isn't exactly what we envisioned for our kids. We made sure they had this opportunity to go to college, and I was fortunate to be able to go to the University of Pennsylvania. And so they, you know, invested a lot of money to get me through. And then they were like, what, baseball? Where is it? But my brother, my older brother, who is 7 years older, he loved the game. And my dad said at one point, well, I never in my wildest dreams would imagine that both of our kids would be in sort of athletics and sports, which my brother also works for the city of Raleigh in the tennis department. So it's, they're a little concerned that we wouldn't be received well. And then I had this unique path of sort of being the African-American / Ivy Leaguer. So I had to blaze my own trail in some ways. And my parents weren't always sure what to advise me on. But in the end, they were very proud and very happy.
Now, if baseball had not worked out for you, and I mean, certainly the odds are against that. There's so many guys who are out there trying to play, high school, college, minor leagues. What was Plan B?
Well, you know, Plan B was, you know, was what I studied in college. I was a systems engineer, and I concentrated in transportation systems. So I would have done something along the lines of working for a city planning, and maybe figured out how to run their transit systems, subways, highways, et cetera. So I did enjoy that, and maybe I would have merged that with baseball or sport in that companies like HOK in Kansas City, they design these newfangled stadiums. That would be a fantastic fit for me to do the engineering side of designing a sports facility or a baseball park. And so I would have found my space. I've had a lot of interest, and certainly baseball was a passion of mine, but I recognize that even as much as I could play the 15 seasons of a career, you still are going to be a young man trying to look for the next thing. So I always made sure I pursued other things.
Well, let's switch to baseball. And before we have to take a break, I want to ask you about two extremes in a young man's career playing the game. Can you recall for our listeners the day that then Chicago Cubs manager Jim Riggleman said the words you've been longing to hear? You made the team.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you, that was a magic moment, and it was a little different flavor because the year before I got called up as sort of a June, then September call-up. So I had a little taste, but there's nothing like breaking spring training as a member of the team. Now you know it's official. And sure enough, yeah, Jim Riggleman in 1997 spring training had a really good spring. Came off of a nice winter ball from the year before and in Puerto Rico. And so he sat down. He's like, you know, congratulations, you made the team. And you know, it was just a surreal moment because I think back to the days of wiffle ball, playing in the front yard, breaking a few windows here and there. And here it was where the major leagues was calling me. And, you know, I knew it was a cherished moment, and certainly it turned out to be everything it was cracked up to be.
And, you know, there's something I've always wondered about. What is the difference in terms of your contract and the way you're taken care of when you make that jump? Are you paid differently? Are the benefits better? What happens to you on the business side?
Well, there's no question it's a huge change. I mean, I noticed a change when I was still in the minor leagues because when you play a certain amount of years, like 3 years in the minors, they can put you on the 40-man roster, which is the roster that's invited to spring training or sort of represents the major league organization. So there's 40. Now each team carries 25, so 15 of those guys are sort of sifted through the minor leagues. But once you reach that 3- or 4-year plateau, I think it's a year into that, they will pay you like a quarter of the major league salary in AAA or in AA, wherever you are. So I remember my checks going from what was initially $850 a month, and that was $327 after taxes, by the way, to a nice jump to about $28,000 a year. And I was like, wow, you know, I couldn't believe the checks, you know, four figures, you know. And and so, yeah, it was, you know, for a young guy who was single, no family, and just living in apartments all in very inexpensive America, I was felt like I was very wealthy.
I would think that would be a great day in a guy's life, that first time, that big jump. And then the other extreme that I wanted to ask you about before we take a quick break, what's it like to be traded? I mean, I can't imagine it's like a very cold day in hell, second only maybe to walking into the next clubhouse for the first time.
Well, I'll tell you, it froze me in my tracks, and it was a, you know, moment. I was drafted by the Chicago Cubs in 1991. So I had my rite of passage in the minor leagues all through the Cubs. So when they finally called me up, which was 96 after basically 5 years, I was like, okay, you know, I've made it. I've finally kind of overcome all these things, detractors, frustration, injuries, and I was there. So my 1980s experience growing up and the loyalty I talked about with the Hall & Oates story is that, you know, I kind of expected to be in the same place for my career. Even though I knew there's a free agency, I thought, okay, I've made it. You know, I finally, you know, earned my stripes, and I'm going to be a Cub. And then they turned around and traded me. And the day they traded me, I got news of my grandfather passed away. So it was a really tough day. And even though I knew I was going to Philadelphia, which was a better opportunity for me, I felt rejected. I felt like, you know, the Cubs didn't want me. But eventually, I come to learn, as I talk about in the book, well, it's also being wanted. You know, it's not just one team may not want you, but another team thinks you're fantastic. So I started to focus on that part, and I really thrived in Philadelphia the first couple of years.
Well, let's take a quick break. This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to the Mr. Media radio interview with ESPN baseball analyst and former player Doug Glanville, whose new book is The Game From Where I Stand. We'll be back in about 20 seconds. Stick around, folks.
Ever thought of hosting your own radio show? Now you can by registering at blogtalkradio.com. While you're there, check out our selection of premium packages. To start your own show today, visit blogtalkradio.com.
Well, this is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to the Mr. Media Radio interview with ESPN baseball analyst and former player Doug Glanville, whose new book is The Game From Where I Stand. Doug, I want to ask you a question. Your picture is not on the cover of this book, and it made me laugh because I got to be honest with you, and you may hate me for saying this. I'm in St. Petersburg. I root for the Rays down here. Before that, I was a Mets fan. I had not followed your career closely enough. I was familiar with you. Had not followed your career closely enough to know if you were African American or white or what you were. And so I was kind of surprised that your picture is not on the book. And I wondered if there was a reason for that.
Well, you know, there was a reason. I mean, I was wonderfully positioned with Times Books, my publisher, that they gave me a lot of opportunity to express creative ideas, and they ran with it. But we were always on the same page. And I didn't want this book to be a celebration of me. You know, like a lot of times you get these, like, oh, well, you know, I did this, I hit this grand slam, I'm wonderful, this is where I came from. I mean, I wanted that, sure, you can introduce the person, but it was bigger than my personal story. And my personal story was a conduit to a bigger perspective of what a life in baseball. And if, you know, my goal, I wanted to humanize the experience, not just sort of glorify it. It was really tangible, ups, downs, in, out, frustrations, success, anxiety. I wanted the whole picture. And being that it was bigger than me, I didn't want my face splashed all over the cover in the, you know, the sort of cliched cover, me holding the ball. And, you know, we've seen that. And the glove and the symbols of the cover of the book was sort of, it was supposed to be sort of a authentic nature to it, a history to it. It was supposed to evoke something that was, you know, baseball, but then you realize, wait a minute, this is an antique. This is something bigger than that. And I wanted to really get away from the sort of autobiographical only sort of storyline and really focus on the voice of the player experience.
Now, I completely get that, but I have to ask you, don't you think that it would have been somewhat inspirational, perhaps, or eye-catching for young African-American men to see your picture on the cover as opposed to, I mean, it's great. It's a great, don't get me wrong, it's a great shot of your glove, your name is on it. It's very cool. But we don't have a whole lot of Ivy League African-American baseball players writing books about their experience.
Yes, well, no, and I recognize that my path was unique and is unique, and I, you know, I celebrate that, and I hope that is a source of inspiration for youth across the board, African American youth, seeing what is possible. There's no question about that, and I feel I can carry that torch in other ways, programming, community service, involvement with charities. There's so many ways that I've tried to sort of take that, but really, what is central to me in my life growing up in Teaneck, New Jersey, which was committed to diversity and integration and harmony, was that, yes, you're from this walk of life, African American in my case, but also you are, you know, you're human and you are everything. You can still embody and embrace so many different perspectives. And I felt that was a little bigger than saying, okay, you know, yes, I'm unique and here's my picture to prove it, here's my resume. I didn't think that had to be as upfront. I thought that could be a little bit more secondary, because in the end, when you talk about it, you get on TV, you do different things, it will be clear that, you know, I have this sort of different walk. So it was just a choice of what we prioritized, and the universality of it allows me to sort of tailor it to, I guess, whoever is sort of is receiving it, because I feel it is, it's got a broad swatch and a broad accessible reach.
Hmm. Well, speaking of pictures, and on a somewhat lighter note, I enjoyed your description in the book of something as mundane as photo day in the major leagues. Can you tell people a little bit who don't know what we're talking about, what photo day is and what effect it can have on players who don't take it seriously enough?
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely, you know, we have these rituals every spring training that, you know, once you get sort of used to the flow of it, you know, you come into camp, you may have a day that you pick out your glove because the vendor's there and so on. But one of the days is photo day, and it's the day that you take all these headshots to, you know, for all the world to sort of reference you by. So whether it's a giant scoreboard shot of you 25 foot tall, you know, or it's, you know, you're on ESPN or some major network and they're saying, well, you know, this guy was speeding 100 miles an hour and here's his mugshot. So all the networks, all the media uses these different shots. So you'll go to station somewhere in the order of 7 in the morning, and you'll go different stations to take different shots and some, you know, a uniform, full uniform. So photo day became this tradition of, okay, rookies get there early, of course, the first level, then the veterans kind of come in. And you have to take it very seriously because this shot is going to memorialize you. And if you're, you know, your hair is messed up, you're kind of like didn't brush your teeth, whatever it is, it's going to be out there for everybody to see. And the other thing is when you're taking your picture at a various station, there's guys waiting online, waiting to go. So they're paying attention. And if you're sitting there smiling like, you know, the Cheshire Cat and you know, you're supposed to be the intimidating closer of the Marlins, it's not going to go over very well. So, you know, you got guys, you got your own critics, and you certainly have fun with it, but the entire first half of the day is dedicated to photo stations, and it's a big part of spring training.
It's funny, as you were saying that, I was thinking of two Rays closers over the years, Roberto Hernandez and Esteban Yan, who we used to call Esteban Yan, who you'd see them on screen and on video, and they were always sweating, and they always looked scared to death. And I got to know Roberto because our kids went to the same school, but nonetheless, that image is really important, isn't it?
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. Now, you know, you could be a total teddy bear, that's fine, but, you know, you got to get up there and think, like, you know, the whole stadium across the world, America, you know, world really is going to be looking at this shot of you. And, you know, ESPN, whatever, you know, all these headshots that are used in different outlets. So this, you know, you have to take it very seriously. You know, Jim Poole is a teammate of mine, and he showed me his minor league baseball card, and he had, his hat was off, his hair was everywhere, he looked like he had run a marathon, and he got caught in that picture, you know, and that was it. There, you can go online, and there's his picture for all to see. So, you know, you take that day seriously, and you can have a lot of fun with it.
Well, let's use the time we have remaining to talk a little bit about your current career. You jumped to the journalism side of the aisle to a degree. Do you view the guys who once covered you as a player any differently now, seeing what goes on this side?
Well, you know, I see it a little differently. I mean, I try to respect the fact I know how hard it is, and I'm an analyst now, so I talk about the game and break it down if guys make mistakes or if they do something, you know, fantastic. But I think what being an analyst, you get a little deeper behind, like, the why or how things happen. And when you're playing, you have to sometimes be very reactionary and very spontaneous in how you assess the situation and then make a decision. So when you analyze it, you can kind of step back and say, okay, the odds weren't with them to throw the slider in this situation, et cetera. So I recognize that the game isn't that slow. But you know, on the flip side, I realize that there's a lot of depth to it, and that sometimes you can add more to your decision making, which now as an analyst I can appreciate. And probably if I was playing after being an analyst, I may approach a few things a little differently, just because you know, I know a lot more.
And do you think that baseball beat writers, and people don't know what I'm talking about, these are the guys who've covered the same team day in and day out all season, year after year. Do you think some of them have, or most of them, have too much invested in their relationships with players and management to cover them objectively and honestly?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the beat writers have a tough challenge because the beat writers are with us all year. They might be on our same flight. They're traveling. So we play 162 games. They're right there with us. So, you know, for them to have the access to the players, they need to build a rapport, a confidence between the player and themselves. And sometimes, you know, will that lead to sort of not being as objective is the question. But what I do appreciate in them, and I'm still very good friends with many of the beat writers over my career, you know, there is a human touch to that, and they think it is a relationship. And when they're in tune with that relationship with the player, they can convey that in a certain light to the fans, where the fans wouldn't ordinarily see it if you were just sort of the cold and calculated evaluator. So I still think it's an asset. I feel like there's probably tough articles they need to write, but on the flip side, you know, if they bury a player with negativity, they may lose that access, and that's going to be not good for anybody. So there is a little bit of a dance, but in the end, I recognize they have a job to do, and I was able to sort of step back at times to say, okay, well, you know, they had to put down what they had to put down, and we can still be cool, just like my brother may do something, and, you know, we're okay in the end.
All right. Well, as we wind down, let me ask you this. Are you one of those guys who has an endless series of books in him, or are you a one-and-out guy?
You know, I have a lot of books. Yeah, and certainly since I've become a writer, I've embraced more. In fact, before I, right after I finished the book, I grabbed a ton of baseball books and just ordered them and had them delivered and just read as many as I could. So I knocked off about 10 in a very short period of time. So I can get it. I'm more of a, I can kind of binge read and I get into it and I go. But I want to read more. I really would like to get more perspective. But, you know, it's not just baseball. I certainly love various topics on anything. But of late, I've been just kind of focusing on baseball history and you know, its relevance.
Well, folks, listen, you can find Doug Glanville's new book, The Game From Where I Stand, at great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. And you can learn more about Doug at his website, DougGlanville.com. And don't miss his regular reports on ESPN's Baseball Tonight, on ESPN.com, or in the pages of ESPN, the magazine. And Doug, thank you so much for joining us at Mr. Media today. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
No, it's a pleasure being on. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir. And folks, for more original interviews with your favorite athletes and sports writers, surf over to our main website, MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. And you can now hear Mr. Media when you're on the go with Stitcher Radio. Stitcher is a free news and talk mobile application. The latest episode of Mr. Media is always available for you. No syncing needed, no memory wasted. It's available for your iPhone, your Palm Pre, your Android phone, or your BlackBerry. Downloading is easy. Go to Stitcher.com and check out the App Store for your individual mobile phone. And please take advantage of this great offer for Mr. Media radio listeners. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Mr. Media to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/MR Media for your free audiobook. Subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. You can follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, twitter.com/andelman, or on Facebook, just search Mr. Media Interviews. Thank you so much for joining us today. Always appreciate you giving up a piece of your day and spending it with us. Thanks. For listening.
Hey, did you know that you can listen to the latest Mr. Media show right on your phone with the Stitcher app? Stitcher's smart radio for your smartphone. Mr. Media is on demand and on the go with Stitcher. Download Stitcher for your phone today. Get the free app at www.stitcher.com. That's STITCHER.com.